I like when a pastor prays like that. That's, I wish that was contagious. Hi, my name is Bill Hansberger. I'm the director of Haven Ministries, and Haven Ministries is a mission organization. Our target mission field is people in non-Christian religions, which means we spend our time talking to Buddhists and Muslims and witches and Hindus and Baha'i and all sorts of interesting people, all of whom, virtually all of them, used to be Baptist and Free Church and Assembly of God, and you name it. Our mission is reaching out to these people. We go to the psyche fairs, we go to people's fair, we go to all sorts of interesting places. And originally I was asked to speak on Islam for the whole month, and then Tal called me and asked me if I could speak on the Da Vinci Code. I have to say, it's the first time I've actually spoken on the Da Vinci Code, so if I screw this up real bad, it is Dave McLeod's fault, because he was one of my influences as a teacher. If I do well, then it's glory to God. So we have it nicely established right here and now. Pastor mentioned that there's a, excuse me, your teaching elder mentioned that there are 22 plus million, it's actually over 25. Publishers estimate that 4 people read every single book that's published. If that's anywhere close to true, then we're talking 100 million plus people have read the Da Vinci Code. And I will tell you this, after flirting with wanting to read it, not wanting to give Dan Brown a dime, finally breaking down and buying the book, and then reading probably somewhere in a range of 50 or 60 different articles and reviews and other books on it, I am stunned that this book sold more than 5 copies. But the fact that it has tells us a lot about not only the book itself and the author, but it tells us a lot about what our culture is all about now. It was just mentioned that we live in a biblically illiterate culture. I'm going to make it even stronger now. We live in a very pagan culture. And the interesting thing, and I'm stalling here until you get your outline, but the interesting thing about what it means to be in a pagan culture is not the culture a lot of you grew up in. I was not raised a Christian. I grew up in an extremely antagonistic home towards Christ. But the options that are available to my kids were not options when I was there. There were no goths and vampires and witches and Buddhists as part of the normal furniture of going to school today in high school in America. Those are all real options for my kids. They were not options for me. Those weren't the kind of things that were available for the choices we have to make. The reason I'm going to this point, you're going to see from the outline there, I've entitled it The Da Vinci Code, Gnosticism in the Postmodern Turn. Let me just introduce the idea of the postmodern turn real quickly here. We live not only in a biblically illiterate pagan culture, but we also live in a culture that has abandoned truth. There's a reason why people are excited about this book. And that is, it excites the pagan soul. I've been going to psychic fairs for at least the last 15 years, full time. I do it all the time. And the more I read this book, the more I realized, I know who his audience is. It's all the people I've been talking to. I've got probably 1,000 New Age books at home. I brought a handful of them here, all of them which are elaborating on the themes that Dan Brown elaborated in the Da Vinci Code. But they did it 20 years ago, and nobody bought it. Or they did it 10 years ago, and nobody bought it. For some reason, this book excited people. And I think partly because of the way it was written, the way it was done, and we're going to talk about that. But also the fact that the audience really has changed in 20-plus years. Things that were deemed absolutely stupid and irresponsible have become wonderfully spiritual now. 2 plus 2 plus 5 has become a deeper, higher truth for many people in our culture now. And into that new context, Dan Brown's book has taken off. And part of the ingenious move of the book is that, of course, he calls it a novel. And I mean, frankly, I'm not up here to waste my time addressing a novel. I'm here to address certain ideas that he expresses in the novel. But this is one of the things about the book that makes it such a powerful sell. If you criticize it for the fact that he's literally wrong on almost every single thing he says about history, art, theology, and so on in the Bible, then the people who defend it say, well, it's just a novel. Of course, it doesn't claim to be just a novel, because once you open the very opening page past the title page is a large block word, fact. Everything in here about art and architecture and the documents and the societies mentioned is in fact true. How wonderful. If he had listed this as a history book, it would have been slaughtered. But he didn't. He listed it as a novel. So it excited people. It was a quick read. It's actually a pretty good read, considering. But his idea is much broader than that. If you go on his website and you see some of the interviews he's done, you realize that he's really a salesman for a whole different point of view. Again, it's different for most of us as Christians. It's not different for our mission. We've been working with this kind of stuff for a long time. But he's here to sell old-fashioned Gnosticism. One of my friends, Peter Jones, has written a very good book on the Da Vinci Code. Peter Jones has a title for his version of this seminar, and he calls it The Gnostic Empire Strikes Back. And that's really what we're talking about here. We're talking about an infusion of a very, very old idea back into the sensibilities of modern people, or postmodern people, whatever you want to call us. And so in this sense, he can play it both ways. If you criticize the history, it's just a novel. But if you're excited about it, wow, this has got deeper truths. This has had new insights. And every once in a while, I'll sit in for Gino Geraci on his afternoon radio show on KRKS. It's amazing how many times over the last 2 years we've gotten phone calls from somebody who says, well, I was trying to witness to my buddy, but he says the Bible was changed and it was all about sacred women and blah, 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 the goddess and everything. Okay, we already know where you're going here. This is the Da Vinci Code. This is an incredibly popular thing. The movie next year is coming out. It's going to have Tom Hanks as the main star and Ron Howard as the director. Do you think it's going to sell? Oh, yeah. And one of the points I'm going to try to end with tonight is to point out what an incredible opportunity this is to talk to people. I'm a missionary. That's what I do. And I'm not up here to bore you with facts that aren't irrelevant. I think in the next couple of years, we as Christians are going to have incredible opportunities to talk with people who think that everything you believe is a crock that was put on you by those mean, nasty Catholic priests who hate women with a passion and who, you know, forced Constantine, or Constantine forced them, it's all up in the air there, you never know, somehow to change the whole course of the Bible and the course of theology. And so as one of Dan Brown's scholars in the book, Robert Langdon, says, the point is that everything our fathers told us about the church is false, told us about Christ is false. Subtle, isn't it? Of course, Dan Brown wants to claim that he's not against Christianity. Nice. Nice try. You know, the amazing thing, again, to me, was that I don't claim to be an art expert. I know nothing about art or architecture. But what I do know about the Bible and about different philosophies, and especially about Gnosticism and goddess worship, this has been my playground for the last 15 years. It was amazingly bad. He doesn't even state his own positions correctly. He doesn't even state what the other Gnostics really taught. And so we're going to basically just introduce that. So this is all a long-winded way of saying that we're going to look at some of the key ideas. I'm going to take just a sample of the mistakes, as you see from your outline. We can just look at a few, because there's so many. I was just amazed. There were some pages, it's like, where do you stop? Almost everything on this page is a blatant lie. But again, the ingenious nature of the book is that almost all of the teaching comes from the two PhDs, the two scholars, who are constantly throughout the book instructing the one cryptologist, about the true nature of religious truth and the true history of the church and all this kind of stuff. So follow along. If you haven't read the book, don't give him money. If you pick it up at a garage sale at best, okay. But it's a critical thing, mainly because it's going to give us wonderful opportunities to witness. People are willing to talk about this. Maybe the closest parallel I can give you is when The Passion of Christ comes out. Everybody wants to talk about it. Even in their anger, they want to talk about it. When Columbine happened several years ago, boy, the whole town, you guys remember, everybody was talking about it. You had to be dead not to be able to witness, because the opportunity to speak to people everywhere. I think this book and movie especially will have that impact. Everybody and their mother will be talking about it. So it gives us a great opportunity as Christians to respond to that. People are going to be bringing this up. So let's go into it. One of the points I want to say here right off the bat is that there is nothing new here. Influences and predecessors. Probably the book that he draws on the most. In fact, one of his scholars actually is an anagram for one of the authors of Holy Blood and Holy Grail. Holy Blood and Holy Grail came out 23 years ago, and it's basically all the same stuff. And he actually mentions it in the Da Vinci Code, but he says they went a little too far, although he agrees with their basic premise. Well, everything about the book, really, you can find in here. The idea somehow that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, that they had children who were secreted away to France, who later became the fathers of the Merovingian line, in other words, Charlemagne, Charles Martel, and all these different people, and that the Jews secreted them away, had all these documents. Mary Magdalene was supposed to be the real leader of the church, but Peter hated her and separated the whole thing. And all this kind of stuff was found in Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Also, a lot of stuff that Dan Brown gets. He gets about the Knights Templars, and he twists that all out of recognition. He also got that from Holy Blood and Holy Grail. So he acknowledges his influences, but interesting enough, the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail are suing him right now for plagiarism. So it'll be fun to see how that all works out. Next one is the Gnostic Gospels. This is mentioned in the book. And this is the only thing even closely related to an academic book, and that's Elaine Pagels. I think he teaches at Princeton. Pagels is a pagan. She's the darling of the goddess world, of the goddess worship world, and very big in feminist spiritual circles. So like I said, this is the closest thing. He doesn't really do too much of it, because if he did, he'd know most of his stuff is wrong. As much as I dislike what Pagels has to say, she's still, we'll talk about the Nag Hammadi text. That's the Gnostic treasure trove of documents they found 65 years ago or so. She will at least describe those accurately. She's a true believer in it. But if you read the Gnostic Gospels, you'll hear about the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Peter and the Gospel of Mary and the Shepherd of Hermes and Acts of Peter and all these books that sound kind of close to you. Almost sounds like the Bible. And that's what was found in Egypt in Nag Hammadi. Well, especially Thomas. If you want to get in a quick argument in the Internet about the true gospel, boy, just punch in the Gospel of Thomas and see what happens. That's become a monstrous thing. If you watch the Jesus Seminar, it comes out every Easter and Christmas, Time and Newsweek, and Peter Jennings just love the Jesus Seminar. It's basically a bunch of hack scholars. But if you take those people seriously, the true gospel is the Gospel of Thomas, not the biblical gospels. And so, again, Da Vinci Code gives a hat tip to that as well. Mentions all these sources, doesn't really go into great detail. One of the other books that's not mentioned, but the idea is all over, is by this professor, Marija Kimbutas. In my doctoral program at the University of Denver, if you get around a certain group of the feminist-minded scholars, Kimbutas I can't really call her, she's the man, but, I mean, it's close enough to it. And she is a powerful influence in the world. She's been dead for several years now, but Kimbutas floated this theory in several of her books in the last 20 years. She's a professor at UCLA, so she's a real academic. She floated this idea that the one stable fact about the world at one point in prehistory, as she says, is that everybody worshipped the goddess. And she allegedly found goddess figurines and statuettes all over the world, and this led her to the startling conclusion that everybody at one point in history or prehistory worshipped the goddess, and this was a time of peace. And this was a time when both sexes were in love, and there were no crime, no poverty, no racism, no sex. Nothing went wrong until that nasty male god showed up out of the Middle East and screwed up everybody. This is just the lifeblood of the goddess movement, and everybody I talk to takes this very seriously. Interestingly enough, Kimbutas was just literally smashed by her peers in the reviews of her theories. Because the fact is, she flat out lied, even though she's a supposedly serious academic. She omitted so many times. They would find a female figurine, but they would always find male figurines as well. She just conveniently left it out of her research. It's an amazing way to build your argument by omission, but that's what she did. The funny thing about that, I was reading a magazine called Magical Blend, which is basically a goddess magazine. And in Magical Blend, they were talking about the reviews Kimbutas was getting. And I never forget one of the editorials, saying, "So what if her facts aren't true? This is about women taking power." Welcome to the postmodern world. It's about women who have been oppressed stepping up to the table, getting their piece of the pie, asserting their power. And if we have to make up stories, well, that's okay, because it's a way of asserting our power. Interestingly enough, formerly one of the big goddess thinkers was another scholar named Cynthia Eller. And she turned traitor. She wrote a book, basically the subtitle was, "How Lying About Our Past Does Nothing to Help Our Future." And from the perspective of a feminist herself, saying, this is bad scholarship, we shouldn't put it forward. But she's been roundly despised by her own group. But you see this model all over the place. Now, this is also forwarded by Joseph Campbell. Joseph Campbell is also dead. He was sort of an academic. He was an archaeomythologist. And as far as I know, he's the only one in the world that has that title. But you can see him on PBS constantly. When PBS wants to raise money, there's Joseph Campbell. And probably most of you have never heard him, even though his book, The Power of Myth, was probably the most popular New Age book in the 1980s. However, even though you've never heard of him, you have heard of his most famous student and neighbor, and that's George Lucas, who the producer of all those wonderful films. He was very open about the fact that Joseph Campbell was the one who inspired him in his quasi-Buddhist, New Age type point of view. Campbell was all over goddess worship as well, and wanted to argue again that if we return to the sacred feminine, to the goddess, why, this will heal all the ills of the world. And that's one of the themes that keeps coming up in the Da Vinci Code, is that that would be the cure for all these problems we've had for so long. And there's other scholars here. I call them the gang. I've got... Let me just bring all these gems up here. Don't want you to miss these. There's so many, I didn't know which ones to bring. The Lost Books of the Bible and the Forgotten Books of Eden. I have probably 8 or 9 of these books with all the Lost Books of the Bible. And what's fun about all the Lost Books of the Bible is that there's so many of them that you couldn't put one Bible in this room if you put all the Lost Books of the Bible back inside it. It's just incredible how many books. Here's some of the interesting books. Infancy. Infancy 2. Christ and Abgarus. Paul and Seneca. Ephesians Half Chapters. That's the name of the chapter. Here's another good one. The Magnesians. Traians, Philadelphians, Smyrnians, Hermas, the visions, Hermas, the similitudes, on and on and on. Again, so many of these. Everybody's claiming they've got the books that were excluded by those mean, nasty Catholics. The Passover plot, again, a different take. This is Schoenfeld's book, came out in the 1980s. But the same idea is that the Bible has been created. It was a giant myth that has been forced down our throats by the Catholic Church, backed up by the empire. And Jesus didn't actually die, and on and on and on. That one's been resurrected for, actually, since Muhammad's day, which we'll talk about next week. Goddess in Every Woman, Jean Shinoda Bolen. Again, one of many goddess books I have. Again, the main theme, and part of me wants to say there's an understanding here that's important to understand. Women, a lot of them, have been hurt. A lot of the women I talk to, their husbands have dumped them, their fathers have abused them, some boyfriend beat them up. There's been some real terrible stories, and I'm not here to sit there and say that this is all just a joke, don't take these things seriously. The fact is a lot of women have been really hurt. What happens as the supposed solution to that terrible problem is somebody comes along and says, hey, look, if the reason that these men did this is because there's a male God being symbolized by the Christian church. If there was just a female God being symbolized, why nothing would ever happen to women. In fact, when everybody worshiped the goddess, here we go again, it was a wonderful world. So we're being told, in so many courses, women are being told, and you can't hardly pick up a copy of Ms. Magazine or Cosmo without having women's spirituality, one section on it. And over again, the theme is when everybody worshiped the goddess, all was right in the universe. And only when that got thrown out of balance did the bad things start to happen. And that's certainly one of Dan Brown's themes. This is actually a serious book on Gnosticism, which I'll talk about later. The Christian Conspiracy, How the Teachings of Christ Have Been Altered by Christians. Oh, yes. Well, again, I have dozens of these as well. Everything was changed. Christians just changed the whole thing and made it all up. Evidence? Nah. Just gets in the way. The fun thing is you don't need it. Now, here's another one that's even more sad. That relates very, very importantly, and I'm glad we don't have many kids here, and I don't mean to be offensive. A lot of what we're going to have to talk about for a little bit of this is sex. And it's because it's a major theme of Dan Brown's book. And it's a major theme in New Age Spirituality Goddess Movement. This is Sexuality and the Sacred Journey by Marina Ray. If I'm not mistaking my New Agers here, I believe Marina was raised on the mission field in Africa by evangelical free church parents. Again, most people I talk to came out of the Christian church, whatever they are now. And so here's all the book about if you just get back to sex. Well, for example, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, this is the right one. Born in Africa to Christian missionaries, the author shares her experience from sexual abuse to sexual addiction, from recovery to ecstasy. By understanding the sacred gift of your woundedness, you can empower yourself and embrace your inner soulmate. Blah, blah, on and on and on. Again, I have hundreds of those kinds of texts all playing up the same ideas. So what I want to do now is just take a survey of some of the more egregious mistakes. I have some overheads to try to illustrate these. Can we kill the thing? I dare say Peter was something of a sexist. Sophie, who is the cryptologist who's being taught all this wonderful stuff. This is St. Peter, the rock on which Jesus built his church. Yeah, the same, except for one catch. According to these unaltered Gospels, meaning the Nag Hammadi, the Gospel of Thomas, and so on, it is not Peter to whom Christ gave directions upon which to establish the Christian church. It was Mary Magdalene. And Peter had a problem with that, Langdon said, pointing to the Last Supper. That's Peter there. You can see Da Vinci was well aware of how Peter felt about Mary Magdalene. Now, there's a problematic approach. How do I prove what happened 1,500 years ago? I point to a picture. And I'm sure it has, I mean, it's just an amazing leap in logic anyways, but it really kind of gives you a capsule of what's going on here. The idea of the Da Vinci Code is that this goddess worship, that's the true nature of actual Christianity, had been hidden, but there was this group of people that started with the Knights Templar who had dedicated themselves to protecting this information, keeping it alive, even though the Catholic Church is constantly trying to stomp them out. And Da Vinci supposedly was one of the grand masters of this whole thing, and he really believed it. And so his way of revealing his true feelings about things was supposedly in his art. And so part of the book is based on the idea that there are all sorts of signals and signs inside Da Vinci's numerous paintings and other documents which really give you a clue to what he really believed. Now, again, I don't claim to be an art expert. It's just we're going to talk about art in a minute. But the overall consensus is nonsense. Nobody takes anything he says seriously, but it's just the mentality you're going to get here. History is pretty much irrelevant, although he quotes it all the time. Now, his defense of all this, you can go on his website and say this. He said, well, you know, and he actually mentions this in the book, history is just written by the winners, so we don't even know what history is. Welcome again to the postmodern turn. There's no certitude. We can't say what happened anywhere. And in a culture where most American students can't put the Civil War in the right century, couldn't begin to tell you what happened with George Washington, what Valley Forge is about or anything, this kind of stuff sells. And if it's not factual, it doesn't really matter because there really are no facts. That's one of the joys of postmodernism. There's only ideas, cultural consensus. That's all there is. And the cultural consensus has been on the wrong side, according to Dan Brown. Oops. The Bible is a product of man, my dear. And remember, these are always the scholars who are doing the teaching. Not of God. The Bible did not fall magically from the clouds, as if anybody argues this. Man created as a historical event of tumultuous times and has evolved through countless translations, editions, and revisions. Histories have never had a definitive version of the book. Let me just say one thing right here. I hear this almost every conversation I have. Virtually every conversation I have in a psychic fair or something like this, somebody says, well, you know the Bible's been changed and mistranslated and translated. Somebody says, you can't really take it seriously. And I just ask a simple question. Can you give me one example of that? I just know it's been changed so many times. I've never yet had a person. There actually are some things that have been changed that you could actually try to make an argument for, although I don't think a good one. But I never have an answer to that question. It's just assumed. This is just urban truth. Okay? People believe it because they've heard it, because they're watching it on a TV show, or they read the Da Vinci Code or something like this. You can't really say what the Bible says. Sad thing is when you hear it from Christian schools. Now, that's another picture, but we can't go into that tonight. So history's never had a definitive version of the book. Okay. Jesus Christ was a historical figure of staggering influence, perhaps the most enigmatic and inspirational leader the world has ever seen. As the prophesied Messiah, Jesus toppled kings, inspired millions, and founded new philosophies. As a descendant of the lines of King Solomon and King David, Jesus possessed a rightful claim to the throne of the King of the Jews. Understandably, his life was recorded by thousands of followers across the land. That ought to give you a hint something's coming here. Teabing paused to sip his tea and then placed the cup back on the mantle. More than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament, and yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John among them. Well, who chose which Gospels to include, Sophie asked. Aha! Teabing burst in with enthusiasm. The fundamental irony of Christianity. The Bible as we know it today was collated by the pagan Roman Emperor Constantine the Great. He was a lifelong pagan who was baptized on his deathbed, too weak to protest. Christians and pagans began warring, and the conflict grew to such proportions that it threatened to rend Rome in two. Constantine decided something had to be done in 325 AD. He decided to unify Rome under a single religion, Christianity. We're going to come back to all this, but I'm going to read. Transmortification. I only write that down because it's only the second person I've ever seen use this in print. And one of my favorite theologians in Calvin and Hobbes, okay, Calvin is always transmortifying. He gets his little box and it turns into a rocket ship. So I thought it was so cool that Brown actually used that there. I've never seen anybody else actually use the word. Nothing in Christianity is original. The pre-Christian god Mithras, called the Son of God and the Light of the World, was born on December 25th, died, was buried in a rock tomb, and then resurrected in 3 days. The newborn Krishna was presented with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Hold on, there's more to this section. And they bring up the divinity of Christ. How'd that come about? I don't follow his divinity. My deity being declared. Until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man nonetheless, a mortal. Not the Son of God? Right. Jesus' establishment as the Son of God was officially proposed and voted on by the Council of Nicaea. Hold on, you're saying Jesus' divinity was the result of a vote? Oh, a relatively close vote at that. Nonetheless, establishing Christ's divinity was critical to the further unification of the Roman Empire into the new Vatican power base. By officially endorsing Jesus as the Son of God, Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who existed beyond the scope of the human world, an entity whose power was unchallengeable. This not only precluded further pagan challenges to Christianity, but now the followers of Christ were able to redeem themselves only via the stable, sacred channel, the Roman Catholic Church. It is all about power. What I mean is that almost everything our fathers taught us about Christ is false. It's hard to know where to start. There are so many, from not only lies to just outright fictions, and that's just being kind. Let's go back through this. Nobody makes the argument the Bible came from clouds. I don't even go into that discussion. But let's look at what it says. History never had a definitive version of the book. Fairy tale. Let's go down here. As a descendant of the lines of King Solomon and King David, Jesus possessed a rightful claim to the throne of the King of the Jews, as probably thousands of other Jews did as well. How many children do you think Solomon had? Lots of wives and porcupines. You remember that whole thing there. And normally we'd list it the other way, since David was the father of Solomon anyways. But one of Dan Brown's major thesis points is that somehow Jesus was blood-related to the kings. Oh. Wow. Technology, I'm catching up. Somehow Jesus was blood-related to the great kings of Israel, therefore he was royal blood. And you find out in another place in the book that Mary Magdalene was also royal blood. See, this was a royal marriage. And this is what gave the French Moravian line its claim to be royalty and all this kind of silliness that he wants to make a big deal of. His life was recorded by thousands of followers. More than 80 Gospels were considered by the New Testament. Well, again, if you don't know anything about the process, and I would say most of the people in most Christian churches don't know anything about it, let alone the pagan public. Again, we just don't know. We don't know our own history. Ask most Christians what the Reformation is about. And they go, huh? Most of us think the church started with our grandparents. We just don't have much of an idea. And I was around a lot of the Promise Keeper folks years ago, and I just was stunned by the fact that I heard so many Baptists and other people saying, well, you know, what's the big deal about the Reformation? It's just an amazingly stunningly sad thing to hear when this is a, you know, professing Christians who talk this way. So when you get in the hands of Dan Brown, who's primarily speaking to the pagan world, they take this seriously. 80 Gospels? Oh, the politics of the whole thing, obviously. That's the inference you're supposed to draw from this. Again, the facts are, if you take seriously all of the books that even call themselves gospel, it's less than 36. And most of those don't even qualify at all, in the sense of saying that they don't even attempt to say anything about the life of Jesus. Most of them, and I'll take the Gospel of Thomas is a good illustration of this, most of them are collections of sayings. And it's like the, you know, just it's like reading Nietzsche or somebody else. Just these odd statements that keep coming in on different subjects. It's not really following a logical pattern. The irony of the Gospel of Thomas, especially as so many feminists allegedly love this gospel, is that the last of 114 different little sections, the last section in the Gospel of Thomas is where Jesus tells Peter that a woman must become a man in order to enter the kingdom of God. How a feminist falls in love with that book, I don't know. But I was the TA for the Buddhism class at DU, and the teacher was honest. She's a professing Buddhist, and she's a hardcore feminist. And she was very honest about some of the more embarrassing stories that the Buddhist told about the Buddha and how he felt about women. And he despised women. There's no argument about that. And here I am with this whole class of young little feminist trust, you know, babies at DU, and they just soaked it all up. Buddhism was cool no matter that Buddha hated women with every ounce of his being. It just didn't seem to matter. In the same way, it doesn't seem to matter to these so-called feminists that the Gospel of Thomas is so misogynist. It just didn't mean a thing to them. All right, anyways, it was collated by the pagan Roman Emperor Constantine the Great, and that's our first historical thing we're going to jump on. It's hard to do this without going into a tremendous amount of detail, but this is one of the biggest fairy tales you'll ever hear about. But again, since we don't know our own history, let me give you another illustration. Shirley MacLaine's book, Out on a Limb, came out 20 years ago, one of the first real big New Age hits, right? She talked about the Council of Nicaea, how they removed reincarnation from the Bible. And she put it in France and had the date wrong, even though it's actually what we call Turkey today. But other than facts like that, it doesn't really matter. The Council of Nicaea never talked about reincarnation. It doesn't matter to the people I talked to, because Shirley quoted it, and of course she wouldn't lie. Of course she would know what she's talking about. And there are many people who respond to the kind of claims that Dan Brown makes and say, well, he couldn't print it if it wasn't true. That's the joy of calling it a novel. You can say anything. Except, again, most of the novel is spent, well, in between the action scenes. It all takes place in one day. You have these long sermonettes from these two professors giving the wisdom. Where did the Bible come together? We have lists of the Bible that go back. In fact, one of the first lists we have is from a guy named Marcion. That was in 140 AD, 180-plus years in front of Nicaea. And he lists several texts. We have a response to him because Marcion was a Gnostic. We have the Moronian canon, which comes up about 50 years later. We have several canons in existence. But one of the interesting things about why the Gnostic texts didn't take off, why they weren't used, most of them show up about 150 to 250 years after the biblical Gospels, which even liberal scholars are now dating in the first century. The fact is that they were never used. How do we know that? Because nobody ever quotes them. You can go on your computer right now and go to the Animacine Fathers. These are all the pastors and bishops and apologists and missionaries and other people who were writing prior to Nicaea. From Clement of Alexandria, about 100 AD, up until Nicaea, 225 years. You can read their sermons, their books. They don't talk about these people. They don't quote the Gospel of Thomas. They don't quote the Gospel of Peter or the Acts of Peter. So one of the central arguments, and I haven't got time to go into detail, but one of the essential arguments of why books were included in the Bible is because the church believed that these were from God. The church believed that these came from eyewitnesses. They were apostles that wrote these things. So these other books come along later, and they all grab apostles' names. Well, the Gospel of Thomas, see, must be an apostle. Good ghost writing, right? Attach it. But when you read Thomas, you find out that Jesus says that everyone's God, and Jesus believes in karma and reincarnation. Well, Jesus becomes another Hindu guru. And that's why I think the Jesus Seminar and people like Dan Brown like the Gnostic text, like the Gnostic Jesus. He sells really well. We'll go more into Gnosticism in a little bit, but again, this is just all a fairy tale. I don't like Constantine for a number of reasons, but this whole little thing about Constantine being a hardcore committed pagan who only did what he did for politics and was baptized only because he was too weak to protest again. As a fairy tale, part of the bad Catholic theology that was running around in a lot of places back then is that your baptism covers your sins up to that point. Anybody raised Catholic will understand what I'm talking about. All right? And since it covers all your sins up to a point, then a lot of people, not just Constantine, were waiting till literally the last possible moment to get baptized, hoping they would cut down the payment for their own sin. That's the problem with bad theology, is you start doing bad things. And Constantine waited. Was Constantine a good Christian fellow? No, there's a lot of historical discussion about his life. Constantine supported both the Christian church and he supported pagan activities. He put money into both. The idea that somehow Constantine united Rome, again, pure fairy tale. Constantine made Christianity legal in 313, the Edict of Milan. His son, Theodosius, 70-plus years later, makes Christianity the state religion. So he's just completely wrong on history. Almost every single point in here. Christians and pagans became warring, and the conflict grew. Again, if you don't know anything, this is amazing. One of the worst persecutions that the Christian church ever had was under the Emperor Diocletian, right prior to Constantine. When Constantine becomes the emperor in 311, he stopped Diocletian from doing what he does. It's interesting to say the Christians were warring. Yeah, they were warring with lions, and they were warring with, being turned into torches and all the other things that were being done to Christians. The Christians were being slaughtered. Some of the worst persecutions in the history of church occurred at this time. So for him to act like there was some huge power play between these two equals, things, and he chose the rising one, which is what he tries to hint to. Nice fairy tale again. Let's go down here. This one's real fun, too. Nothing in Christianity is original. The original pre-Christian god, Mithras. Well, again, this is a nice fairy tale. Mithras is actually a Persian god. It goes back six centuries before Christ. So there's some material about that god. But the god that the Romans dealt with was basically a soldier god, a warrior god. He was very popular in the army. We don't have anything predating the time of Christ about Mithras. What we do find out about Mithras comes about 100 years after Christ. And in most of those documents, we find all sorts of interesting things, like the baptism of Mithras, where you stand under a bridge and above you on this bridge was a bull, and they cut the bull's throat, and the blood would go all over you, and that was the baptism. So the soldiers really got off on this thing, but nevertheless, it had nothing to do with the Christian church. But he wants to tie them together somehow. Again, nice fairy tale. Mithras called the Son of God and the Light of the World. You will not find a single scholar on Mithras who will record this stuff. Nobody's ever heard of this before. Thin air, apparently, or actually other New Agers. Was buried in a rock tomb, resurrected in 3 days. Again, where did that come from? Nobody knows. Pure fairy tale. The newborn Krishna was presented with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Again, these, I pulled out just a few of the more egregious illustrations. I've read the Bhagavad Gita. I talk to Krishnas all the time. I talk to Hindus all the time. The Bhagavad Gita is an incredibly important book in India, and it says nothing about his birth. But again, we're just talking about facts and details and, you know, history that you can make up on the spot. This is my point. He's just an egregious, either great fairy tale writer, or he's an egregious liar. But I would say the attitude of the book is, and I would say the attitude you get from Dan Brown from hearing his conversations, is that he sees himself as a revolutionary, striking back at the evil of the Christian movement. Some other historical disasters, the Templars. Oh, he's got the Templars doing everything in medieval Europe. They created most of the great cathedrals. Again, you'll not find a single scholar. He has them being wiped out by the evil Catholic Church. They were actually, most of them, a lot of them were killed by Philip of France. Again, not a single detail right. It's just hard to take him seriously when he gets close on nothing. And I put here Wicca and goddess worship. One of the more egregious quotes here, in my mind, because it's such an important story with witches. Here we go. The Catholic Inquisition published the book that arguably could be called the most blood-soaked publication in human history. I would actually say Das Kapital is, but that's another story. Malleus Maleficarum, or the Witch's Hammer, indoctrinated the world to the dangers of free-thinking women, in quotes, like it comes out of that book. No, it doesn't. And instructed the clergy how to locate, torture, and destroy them. Those deemed witches by the church included all female scholars, priestesses, gypsies, mystics, nature lovers, herb gatherers, and any woman suspiciously attuned to the natural world. Doesn't say that either, but it's in quotes again. Midwives also were killed for the heretical practice of using medical knowledge to ease the pain of childbirth, a suffering the church claimed that was God's rightful punishment for Eve partaking of the apple of knowledge, thus giving birth to the idea of original sin. During 300 years of witch hunts, the church burned at the stake an astounding 5 million women. The propaganda and bloodshed had worked. Today's world was living proof. Women, once celebrated as an essential half of spiritual enlightenment, had been banished from the temples of the world. There were no female Orthodox rabbis, Catholic priests, nor Islamic clerics. The once hallowed act of Hieros Gamos, and this is the sacred sex thing, which we'll get to in a minute, that he alludes to several times. The natural sexual union between man and woman, through which each became spiritually whole, have been recast as a shameful act. Holy men who had once required sexual union with their female counterparts to commune with God now feared their natural sexual urges as the work of the devil, collaborating with his favorite accomplice, woman. Now, again, there's enough Catholic writers who actually reflect some of these ideas that you could draw some of this out of that. But when I said this is goddess, you know, basically gossip, he's actually even got the number wrong. Most of the witches I've talked to, and I've talked to witches in different parts of the country, interesting enough, for the first 12 years I was doing this, every witch I talked to had been raised Baptist. And since the majority of them were, I was a conservative Baptist missionary at the time, all of them had been raised Southern Baptist. So it was a good thing to bring up with my Southern Baptist friends, you know, how well they're doing with the pagan world. But the fact is that almost every witch I've ever talked to, in fact, every witch I've ever talked to, I've read about a couple that weren't, every witch I've ever talked to was raised Christian. And the amazing thing is that one of the things that they're kind of their badge of honor is that Christians killed 9 million women during the Middle Ages. Why would you want to be with a group like that? And you can see this if you watch PBS right before Halloween, not that I recommend it, but if you do, you see a series of movies called The Burning Times. And this is three different movies that they put together. And again, it's the same thing. All the ministers hated women, and they wanted to kill all the women who were a threat to their power, on and on and on with this whole fairy tale. I've got health videos on different subjects, and they talk about, everybody's talking about the burning times. And all this comes from one guy, this English civil servant named Jerry Gardner, who in the 1950s wrote a book called Witchcraft Today. It kind of reintroduced the world to the joys of witchcraft. At least that's how he saw it himself. A lot of people think this is a whole new religion. He basically started the whole thing. But Jerry Gardner says on this one page that Christians killed 9 million witches. And I've run into this all over the country, from 12-year-olds to 50-year-olds reciting this number as if it was gospel fact. The interesting thing is, if you read the same paragraph, Jerry Gardner also says, we have no idea about where these numbers come from, whether they're true or not, and we don't even know if these people were witches. But that part never gets repeated. Fact is that the most, and I'm not here to bless the Inquisition by any stretch, but the most liberal of historians puts the number at about 300,000 people total, men and women, killed in the Inquisition. It's all wrong as far as I'm concerned. Most more honest historians would put the number closer to 30 to 60,000, somewhere in there. The thing is about the Inquisitors, you have to understand about them, they took good records. They got brownie points within their order if they told you how many people they put to the question. That's what the Inquisition was all about, putting people to the question. So if they put 100 people in a village to the question, then they would record that. So we have pretty good statistics from this. But I have a paper on witchcraft on my website and a presentation called Why Not Burn Witches, and it goes into this in great detail. I quote all sorts of scholars, and if you want to read the subject, an excellent book came out by a University of Washington scholar 2 years ago called To God Be the Glory, Rodney Stark. He's not a Christian that I know of, but he's talking about the Christian relationship with witchcraft and slavery and science. A very good read. I would highly recommend it. But again, these numbers just come from outer space, but they are worn on people's sleeves as if they are victims. Witches are perpetual victims. And every time I've gone to a witchcraft meeting, you know, this is one of the things that comes out very quickly. We have been persecuted for thousands of years by those evil Christians. And I'm in a room of people who used to go to church. And then they become instant victims, you know, because the evil Christian church. Again, this is all space numbers. They made it up. And again, if you want to grab my paper, Why Not Burn Witches, there's some more historical documentation. But again, it's a nice fairy tale. Sells really well. All right, artistic mistakes. Again, I don't claim to be an artist. Let me just say this about all these examples. Da Vinci and drag. I don't know. One of the major themes of his book is that Da Vinci was a flaming, flaming homosexual who sometimes hid himself in his documents and did everything else. And I read probably 20 reviews that quoted serious art scholars saying, where did he get this? Is there some charge that Da Vinci was homosexual? Yeah. That charge has been around in a while, that he was flaming, that he was out of the closet. There's no evidence of that at all. Brown claims he was constantly working from the Vatican. He had one contract with the Vatican. There's all sorts of just, again, historical mistakes. His big things are on stuff like the Last Supper. If you take Da Vinci's famous painting, he claims that the person who's leaning on Jesus, who most art historians say is the Apostle John, he says that is Mary Magdalene. So it's key to his idea, to his whole thesis, that Mary Magdalene was close. Now, Peter's off to one side in the picture. And Peter's pointing. And Dan Brown goes into a whole huge thing about how what he's really doing, he's threatening her with a knife. Look at the painting. Nobody else seems to see what Dan Brown sees in this painting. But this is typical of his approach to things. Same thing with the Mona Lisa. What is the Mona Lisa? Why, this is Amon and Isis. Two pagan deities mixed together, so the Mona Lisa is androgynous. Every art historian I read said this is nonsense. In fact, Mona is short for Madonna, and virtually every historian, including Da Vinci's number one student, said this was a woman. I haven't got her names in a lot of my reviews. This was a woman in Florence that he used for his painting. But again, that doesn't fit the thesis, so we just go with our own story. He takes Isis, and somehow melds that together as Mona Lisa. He's wrong about the Louvre. Again, he claims there's 666 window panes. Wrong. There's just hardly a fact that he's right about. He's wrong about his take on the Madonna of the Rocks. Again, another one of Da Vinci's famous paintings. If you can notice on the bottom part of the second page, I have a lot of websites, several good books to read. If you want to get into more of the details, all I can tell you is just look these up. You'll see all the stuff for yourself. Theological mistakes. Also the kind of thing that makes you wish you got paid money for this sort of thing. He claims that the Tetragrammaton, Yahweh is how we pronounce it, we don't know how it's pronounced, was taken from the word Jehovah. Now, I admit that I was under Dave McLeod's teaching for a while. Years of therapy have helped, thank you. But anybody who studies anything at all about the development of theology knows what a fairy tale this is. I mean, this is just for theologians who read this. Every theologian I read from Daryl Bach to all sorts of other people, said this is just one of the most amazingly stupid things he could have said. The term Jehovah comes from a mixture of the word Yahweh with the vowels of Adonai. It's really a 16th century creation. Nice thing to remind your Jehovah's Witness friends about. But the reality is he turns that completely around. And then he has the nerve to say that Jehovah is an androgynous God, meaning a mixture of male and female, and the Yah is the male part, and the Hava is the female part. It's actually he uses these words, a pre-Hebraic name for Eve. Great, we know a lot about the pre-Hebraics. We haven't got a clue what this came from. But anybody who's taken all 5 minutes of Hebrew, and I haven't, but just I have all sorts of other friends who have, knows what the word Hava is all about. It's the to-be verb of Hebrew. It's amazing. This is the word that comes out of Exodus 3:14 that's usually translated, like in the King James, I am that I am. It's the word for existence. And he takes that as the name for Eve. But it gets more special. Look at the next one. He says that Jehovah was the male god, and in the ancient temple worship under Solomon, he claims, Jehovah would have sex with his female consort, Shekinah. It's fun when you can just make it up as you go. It doesn't matter if you're a child, because most people don't care and don't know. They just know they like the thesis. I hate the church, therefore this smells good. And this says I can have sex with everybody I want. Hey, I like this idea. Facts just get in the way. Well, again, 5 minutes of Bible college can fix this again. What was the Shekinah, which is never mentioned in the Old Testament by that name? This is the cloud of glory that surrounded the temple. It was never, ever seen. Now, the interesting thing, again, I've not even seen this one in most of the goddess books I've ever seen. The goddess people that people keep trying to sneak back into the Old Testament is Sophia, which is the Greek word for wisdom. Interesting, it's also the name of one of the key players in this book. That's the goddess people want to say is in Proverbs 8 and all sorts of other places. There's the real goddess figure. Sophia, wisdom, was the real goddess of ancient Israel. Now, I've never heard anybody claim the Shekinah was, but he's got them having sex there in the temple, and that's what all the priests did, and all the male good followers of Yahweh would come in and have sacred sex. And this is just an amazing thing. There's an interesting book by Dennis Prager, who's a conservative Jewish columnist. You might hear him on the radio often. And Dennis has written a good book called Why the Jews? And he's talking about why there's been this historic persecution of Jews. And although I think he misses a couple of very important things, most of this is really stunning. One of the things I had not really thought through before that he brought up is that what the Torah came in and did. The Torah comes in with all the grocery lists most of us hate. You can't have sex with your aunt and your cow and your daughter and your daughter's daughter. And, you know, all these lists that most of us just want to read through as fast as we can. You have to realize how revolutionary that was in the pagan world. In a world where it's very common to have sex with everybody in your family. You can read about this kind of thing in Platonic literature. You can read it in the Roman literature. It's just all over the place. The pagan world loves to have sex with anything and everything. And in comes the Torah and says no. And Prager makes a rather compelling case, I think, that it was this long-standing anger of the pagan world against the Torah, which we as Christians inherit, of course. This hatred about having rules on sex. Let me give you an illustration more modern than that. I attended a session called led by a group called the Covenant of the Goddess. It's the largest group of goddess worshippers in the country. It's kind of an umbrella group for them. And I heard their president 12 years ago named Phyllis Perrault. And Phyllis is a New York attorney, very attractive. She's on The View, Good Morning America, USA Today. And she's really, you know, hip and fresh, everything that witches want to be represented by, not some old crone with a funny nose and a hat. And so Phyllis has 1 hour to explain Wicca 101. Each of the different religions at this thing that I was at got to do that. I would estimate that Phyllis spent one half of that time talking about how bad Christianity is, as opposed to talking why you should be a witch. And the main reason Christianity is so bad is that Christians have ruined sex. Christianity has rules. And what we have to do is, of course, cast that aside and restore sex to its proper place of worship. In that sense, you can see her and Dan Brown getting along famously here. It's all about the return of this. I have a ton of quotes, which I won't have time to show you, from all sorts of other people like Matthew Fox, a Dominican priest at the time, who wrote a very, very popular New Age book called The Cosmic Christ, saying that what we need to do to get worship back where it needs to belong is to restore eros and ecstasy. Well, scholars call that sacred sex and sacred dance. Where did he get this inspiration? Well, he went to a rave. If you don't know what a rave is, it's basically a lot of sex, drugs, and techno music, and he went to one in London and saw all these kids having sex, wild music and everything going on, and he says, this is what the church needs. We've got to bring this back into the church. Now, he's an educated man. He's not an idiot. He knows what the ancient mystery religions, what the old pagan worship ceremonies were like. He's also somebody who would be in the same ballpark as Dan Brown, the sacred sex motif. Anyways, this is what he's saying constantly. All this was the case for the Jews and then for the early Christians. Jesus had sex, therefore he was a good guy and he had children, therefore we should be having sacred sex as well. And so Jesus and Mary become the penultimate couple in this respect. Suppressed Gospels, I mentioned this before. Again, if you look at them, there's a reason why they're not quoted. The first time we hear any of the Christians responding to them is one of the early fathers, Irenaeus, who's in the second half of the second century, writes a book called Against the Heretics, which he goes into some detail attacking the Gnostics' writings, and he mentions the Gospel of Thomas, but you hardly see it anywhere else. What makes these people so excited, like Elaine Pagels, about the Gnostic text, is that all they've ever had before was what Christians said about it. Now, if you're going to quote something, there's kind of a simple rule about quoting. Something has to be in existence for you to quote it. Kind of, oh, duh, right? You can't quote something that's not there. I don't find it accidental, and you can make a real case for the dating of the New Testament this way, but I don't find it accidental that none of the early church fathers are quoting these guys. There's a lot of church history about Cerinthus and some of the other early Gnostic leaders who were problems for the church. But they don't quote the Gospel of Peter, they don't quote the Gospel of Philip, they don't quote the Gospel of Mary, all these supposedly early, unaltered, as Dan Brown says, Gospels. They don't quote them. Believe me, if they were wrestling with them, as antithetical as these two groups are, you would think that they would be addressing it. But it's not there. So the idea that somehow these things were there and suppressed just makes no sense at all. All right, next page real quickly here. Oh, boy. Gnostic mistakes. Here's where I want to try to make a case that Dan Brown doesn't even know what he's talking about concerning his own belief system, let alone Christians. The magic of the pagan world. What do I mean by this? Well, paganism, you don't have to go too far away. You can see classic paganism in all sorts of places, especially in places like India or Thailand or that. The pagan mindset divinizes the world. There is God in everything. Of course, you don't have to go to India. You can watch Pocahontas from Disney and get the same idea, that the divine is in all things. Now, for the Muslim world, as you'll see in the next couple of weeks, to say anything in this world is divine is to commit shirk, the ultimate blasphemy. That's why the Hindus and Muslims will never get along in their orthodox sensibilities, because they're just as far apart as possibly can be. Well, the pagan mindset has no problem. We had a slide shown to us by my Hindu professor, and she got her PhD in Hinduism. She brought home a slide of a white, starch-white goddess statue. And all over the statue had red splotches. And she asked us, she says, what do you think this is, what are they worshiping here? Anybody here want to guess? They were worshiping the smallpox virus. To the Hindu, that makes perfect sense. Whether it's the rat, smallpox virus, a tree, a frog, everything is an expression of the divine. Everything is masking the divine. God is in all things, everything. That's what the New Age says is kind of modern-day Hindus. Well, in this sense, that was the pagan mind. So for a pagan to engage in sacred sex made perfect sense. This is what went on in Corinth. Corinth had literally tens of thousands of prostitutes. And in order to get a good corn crop, in order to keep the river from overflowing, in order to make sure that the stars turn the right way, you had sex with the temple prostitutes. We get a glimmer of that in 1 Corinthians 6. And some of the ancient texts talk about it. There was actually one temple prior to the Romans destroying Corinth in 300 B.C., there's actually one temple that had 1,000 prostitutes who were just freebies for all the visitors. And that's just one temple. Corinth was to sacred sex like Vegas is to gambling today. It's what they were known for. And so in this mindset, sacred sex has been around in all sorts of parts of the world. And the Wiccans bring it back. But it's not alone in witchcraft to this part of the world. It actually, you can find this in ancient India as well. It's called Tantra. And it goes through Hinduism and it goes through Buddhism. Or if you get into Tibetan Buddhism, who's the closest thing to Jesus Christ on earth according to our media today? Well, it's the Dalai Lama. If the Western media was honest about Tantra and how closely that is tied to the Tibetan Buddhism practiced by the Dalai Lama, you would be freaked out. And I'm not even going to talk about it because it's just gross beyond belief. But let me just summarize by saying this. The more grotesque and perverted the sex act, the more spiritual. That's the mentality. And that's what was going on in much of these world. So when Dan Brown wants to say that it's all about sacred sex, well, he has part of a point there. There was certainly a lot of sacred sex going on, but there was a lot more going on in the pagan world. And as much as Gimbutas and others want to pretend that it's not, sacred death was just as important as sacred sex. Sacrifice. If you didn't get what you didn't get a good enough corn crop with sacred sex, well, then you turned to more powerful tools. Or like the Mayans did, they would slaughter their victims, their slaves, to make sure the sun would come back the next day. Or again, to make sure the river didn't overflow. Or to make sure that the neighboring village wouldn't attack you or something like this. You can see this all over the place. You can see it in Jeremiah 7 when the Jews start imitating their neighbors. And in the archaic language of the King James, they pass their children through the fire. Why? Well, because the Canaanites were Baal worshippers. What were the Baals? There's not just one Baal or Baal. There is lots of them. What are they? They're nature gods. A god of the fish, a god of the corn, a god of the tree, a god of the sun. They also had mystery religions. Caesar himself, Julius, talked about going to the mystery religions. And one of the big ones that I studied a lot many years ago when I was at the University of Nebraska was on Eleusis, which is a field outside of Athens. And Caesar said, I can't even tell you what's going on down there. It's so incredibly profound. But what scholars have put together, this is basically about a month-long orgy. And you'd have sex with everything inside, and it's kind of the early equivalent of MTV's Real World. Sex and drugs and the early equivalent of rock and roll. And at the height of this, when everybody's completely sensually blown out, they would reveal the mystery. What was the great mystery of all, the great spiritual sign they were all there for? It was an ear of corn. Now, if you're like Dave and you're from Iowa, that's probably very profound for you. But the fact is this is the connection. Sacred sex and the turn of the world, how the world is created, were tied together. And so was sacred death. This is probably most institutionalized in Hinduism, particularly through Shiva, the destroyer, and Kali, his girlfriend. If you ever see a picture of Kali, you don't miss Kali. She's the black goddess with skulls all around her and skulls in her hands, and she's on a bed of stones, and she's there to kill. In some of the Hindu legends, she even kills Shiva, her boyfriend. That's considered normal in Hindu thought processes. Because death is a part of this world, or the Hindu says the illusion of this world. Well, in this respect, sacred death was just as critical, whether it's the Celtic versions that were all across northern Europe, or you can find it in all sorts of other places as well. You see the sacred sacrifice. Interesting enough, when I was at the University of Nebraska, it's 1988, not so long ago, I took this class on mystery religions, and the scholar of the day, the man, was a guy named James Frazer, who wrote a book about 100 years ago called The Golden Bough. None of you ever heard of him. When I got into DU 15 years later, James Frazer's despised, hated, not even worth reading. He's an idiot. Why? Well, because Gimbutas doesn't like him. Why? Because James Frazer's, the major theme of the Golden Bough is to point out human sacrifice in almost every culture of the ancient world. Like we found out our good friends down here, the Anastasi, over just the last 10 years, if you live in Colorado, we found out a few more things about them, haven't we? Like the fact that the human teeth marks all over the bones. Kind of a weird thing about that. I thought that wonderful prehistory people just loved them. Yeah, they loved so much they ate each other. Well, anyways, Gimbutas is on the rise. James Frazer is despised. But I don't think it's because the evidence has changed. I think it's because he brings up something people don't want to know about. I want to hear how wonderful it was when we worshiped the goddess, supposedly. Next, the sacred feminine. Again, a huge part of Brown's theme is based all around this. But is it really the theme he wants to make it? And actually, that's the problem with Gimbutas and basing your ideas on her theories, is that there's no evidence for this sort of thing. Was there sacred sex? Absolutely. But there's almost always male gods. In fact, there's usually more male gods in most of the ancient, again, look at all the different, whether it's the Babylonian or the Egyptian or the Greek or the Roman, you look at all these different pantheons of gods, collections of gods, as it were. There are female goddesses that are very powerful, but in almost every one of them, there's more male gods. So the history of this and the evidence is so scant, it's unbelievable. He still makes it his major theme. And if you look at the Gnostics themselves, which we're going to go into for just a minute here, they're not good feminists. Did they worship the sacred feminine? Yeah, but that did not make them feminist in the way Dan Brown wants to intimate it. Let's talk about the real gnosis. Gnosis means knowledge. And Gnosticism comes from this idea of a secret band of knowledge. In that sense, he's got this right. Even though the prior of Zion and Sion and all these different things he just makes up out of thin air for the most part. There is this secret knowledge idea that the Gnostics have, but it had nothing to do with the fact that we're missing the goddess or something like this. The true idea of Gnosticism is that this world is a prison. And this world was created by the worst of all gods. Unlike the, say, the Greek, the classic pantheon most of you heard about, like Zeus and Hera and all these different gods, all of whom have jobs and stuff, the Gnostic pantheon was a hierarchical one, more like Aristotle's thought. And at the top, one of the top gods, the Gnostics put Jesus. Just like Dan Brown, even in the quote I showed you, Dan Brown doesn't come out and say, Jesus is an idiot, don't take him seriously, don't even listen to him. He never says that. No Gnostic ever talked that way either. Oh, Jesus is, oh yeah, he's great. He's so high. What an incredible divine leader, blah, 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 blah. They love Jesus. But in this hierarchy, at the bottom of the hierarchy of the whole list, was a god they nicknamed the Demiurge. And who is the Demiurge? It's Jehovah. It's Yahweh, the God of the Jews. The Gnostics despise the Jews with every ounce of their being. Why? Because the Jewish God takes responsibility for making the world. And this world is an evil prison. Now, just to show you, these ideas don't go away. Anybody here remember Heaven's Gate, the group in San Diego that killed themselves 6 or 7 years ago? I'm supposed to be an expert. Funny word. I went on their webpage. I never heard of this bunch. In the same morning, everybody's looking at these terrible pictures of all these people who committed suicide. And this story comes out about the Hale-Bopp comet and UFOs. And I have to say, I go to a lot of New Age meetings. The UFO meetings are the weirdest of the weird. I mean, even for New Agers, they're beyond weird. It's so stunningly strange. Well, other than that comet, nobody really knew much about this group other than this thing about the Hale-Bopp comet. So I go on their webpage, and I don't even know it's up anymore. There might be because there's still some followers alive. But on the desktop was a button that said, our position against suicide. How ironic is that? So I clicked to that button, and it's like I stepped back 2,000 years. It's one of the best written explanations of Gnosticism I've ever seen. See, for them, we are divine beings who have been trapped in this evil world of matter. To stay here in this world is suicide. But we are freeing ourselves from this evil matter which has trapped us and held us down, and we are freeing our divine selves to go through the universe. That's classic Gnostic thought. One of the Gnostics' old illustrations was the sun. And each of the, as the sun rays emanate out, these are called aeons. And the aeons were divine beings, part of the sun. And somehow they got trapped by that nasty Jewish God who tricked them into matter. Sounds like Scientology, too, but I'll get into that another time. Tricked them into getting stuck here in matter. And they're so trapped. And so therefore we must free ourselves from matter. All right. That was the Gnostic ideal. And the secret knowledge is your true self, is that you are not this matter. All right? You can hear that from Yoda in The Empire Strikes Back. Tell Luke, you're not this fleshly matter. Same exact idea. We're not this body that God created. God created body and soul together and pronounced it very good. An idea despised by everything from Hindus, Buddhists, New Agers, and the Gnostics especially. Hindus had a slightly different twist on this, and Buddhism as well, and following Hinduism. They call it Maya, the illusion. The body's a dream. It doesn't really exist. Think the Matrix here. The world of perception is not the real world. All right, the Gnostics had an angrier twist on it. It's a prison. We must get out of it. We are divine beings who have been trapped. Again, if you read New Agers like Anthony Robbins and Deepak Chopra and a zillion others, you'll hear the same kind of idea flow through. Well, those people in Heaven's Gate just took it more seriously than most. The world is a prison. I'm getting out. All right, that's classic Gnostic thought. Now, here's what's funny, because it's similar in Hinduism. Hinduism says the world's an illusion. That's the foundational statement. Two different ways you can act like that or respond to that. One camp of Hinduism says the world's an illusion. Therefore, do nothing. Whatever you do attaches you to this world, and you don't want to be attached to this world. You want to get off the wheel. You want to get out of here. So do nothing. Nothing good, nothing bad, nothing at all. And especially don't have sex. All right, Buddhism takes on that theme as well. Then the other extreme of Hinduism is in Tantra. The world's an illusion, therefore have sex with anything and everything, and it's okay. It's even more special that way. Two extremely antithetical points of view based on the same lame foundation. Same thing's true in Gnosticism. So when Dan Brown wants to point to the Gnostics, they were really all about sacred sex. Again, he's telling a half-truth because he doesn't know what he's talking about. Gnosticism had the same thing. The world is a prison. And you had several very prominent Gnostic teachers saying, it's a prison. Don't get involved. Don't touch anything. Don't do anything. Don't eat anything. You can see this in Colossians chapter 2. chapter 1 and 2 of Colossians, 1 John 4, there's several passages in the Bible that are addressing Gnostic ideas. And one of these very important ideas that comes out there is that you can't touch, you can't handle, you can't do these things. That is one Gnostic response. But an equal and totally antithetical response, again, the world's in a prison, therefore, you should experience everything in it. That's why you're imprisoned here. You're imprisoned here to have sex with anything and everything you can, to break all the known rules of all societies and cultures. And you see both these extremes, even though they're based on the same foundation. So when Dan Brown points out it's all about sacred sex, again, he's only painting part of the story. And a whole lot of the Gnostics would have disagreed with him drastically. So my point being is that he doesn't know what he's talking about. And virtually everything, and guys, this is just a scatter approach to it. If you go through and read some of those articles I pointed out, if you want just a quick reads first, it's just incredible how wrong he is on virtually everything he says. But let's summarize what do we do about this. Dan Brown himself says that this is all about starting a conversation. Again, you can, if you watch his interviews, go to his website, he says, well, yeah, maybe there's a few things that are off, but it's really about talking and starting a discussion. To that I want to say, okay, fine. Let's start a discussion. Guys, you have to be dead not to witness at this time. Everybody's talking about this kind of stuff. It really takes something as egregiously offensive as, hey, what do you think of that Da Vinci Code thing? Everybody starts talking. Again, I would say getting into this subject, understanding a little bit of how just how deadly wrong it is and how important it is to understand what the Bible actually says about some of these things is not only good for our own faith, building up our own faith by getting into the Scriptures more, but it can be a wonderful tool to witness to your neighbors, your coworkers, your family, and friends. This is going to be a topic of discussion for at least a couple more years, and so I think it's a great opportunity for us. So if he wants to say it's about starting a conversation, I said amen and amen. Let's go for it. Let's talk. And I think, again, the thing about most Christians, I've always believed why most Christians don't witness, I think we're scared. Somewhere out there is a smoking gun that somebody will have a question I can't answer or something like this. I've got every religious point of view you can imagine in my library. Guys, if there's a smoking gun, I somehow have missed it. Right, are there big issues about the faith? Actually, at one point in the whole book, it's the only honest question in there. When he talks about the claims of Christianity, how evil it is. What about all the suffering in the world? Bingo. That's the one honest question that I think really exists for Christians to wrestle with. And I think non-Christians and Christians both end up wrestling with it, whether they do it well or not is another subject. So I do think that's an important one, but that's really not the focus of his book, obviously. But it's a very important thing for most people, and I think we should start the conversations. Secondly, the culture has abandoned facts, truth, and ultimately wisdom. How do we respond? What does it mean to be in a culture where 2 plus 2 equals 5 to virtually everybody you meet? Well, this is one of the joys of postmodernism, is that people are wonderfully selective postmoderns. They're not postmoderns when it comes to their paychecks. I can guarantee you that a couple of my professors at DU, if they're supposed to get $6,000 a month and they go down there and their check says $60, I guarantee you when they go into the main office of the school, they don't want to hear about how the text is open for interpretation and anybody can interpret the text any way they want and how narrow-minded is you to interpret only your way of 6,000 when we freely interpret it as 60 and our community says it's only 60. Therefore, you should be happy with our community's interpretation and we should be tolerant of each other's point of view. That's not going to happen. All right? I always talk about very practical things when I talk with New Agey postmodern types. I love that commercial that Oak Express did a couple years ago. You see it quite often every once in a while still. Where the guy goes into the holistic car shop. And the guy starts doing muscle testing on his arm to see what's wrong with his car. And he's testing the strength. And I'm not going to go into all the details where this comes from. He's testing the strength of his arm. And he goes, ah, calipers. Calipers. And he calls his mechanic, calipers on this car. And the other guy's like, what? And the next thing you see, after they do the little commercial bit, is a guy out there doing sage and putting smoke all over the car to fix the calipers. I mean, you know what? You can think that way like you want, but nobody's going to take their car to that shop, not even a New Ager. Nobody lives in that world. They can talk about it all they want. They don't live there. They live right here. So I try to get very basic. I start sometimes real simple things. You're an engineer? You're a plumber? You teach? You have kids? I talk about things that they know are real. And if they can know those things are real and know the truth about those things, then you can start building an argument outwards from that whole point. You don't have to cover all the philosophical bases in one setting. If you can get them to understand that there are things that are verifiable and true in this world, you've undermined the whole postmodern mindset. And I think we have to be very good at it. Right? I tell all my interns, of which I've had many over the years, that we need to be the sharpest pencils out there, folks, because our world has abandoned rationality. At the risk of going a minute or two over time, sorry, Alex. Let me tell you a story about that same thing where I met Phyllis Kroth. This is the most bizarre New Age meeting I've been to. It wasn't led by somebody from Boulder. It wasn't led by people from Westwood or something like that in L.A. or the Village in New York. The most bizarre New Age meeting I was led by MIT professors, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It was at the Parliament of World Religions in 1993 in Chicago. 5,000 people, academics from Oxford, Cambridge, Cal Berkeley, Stanford, University of Chicago, University of Texas, Austin, you name it. 5,000 people in this room, religious dignitaries from all over the world, gurus of all stripes. And I'm sitting there in the back of the room with a friend of mine from Jews for Jesus that I just met. He'd never been to a New Age meeting before, so I wanted him to get the real thing. And we go in there, and the one professor from MIT said, "Want everybody to stand up, put all your stuff on the floor." And she's really excited. And I said, "Oh, good, group rope," because you have to understand, when you abandon your mind, you have to do something with your time, okay? So everything's down. So the lady sits there and goes, "I want everybody in the room," this is 5,000 people, "I want everybody in the room to share their noise." And she rings a little bell. And for 2 solid minutes, the whole room is like, "Ah!" like this. And I nudge my friend again. I said, "If I could just bring my junior high group here, I'd bring them some noises they could share, you know." This goes on. Then she rings the bell again to stop it. And you can't believe the reaction. People are crying. People are weeping. They're laughing. They're going hysterical. "Oh, my gosh, that was so incredible. That was so incredible." She's trying to calm them down. Wait, there's more. She goes, "This time I want you to share your noise, but listen to other people's noise." Ah, for another 2 minutes, rings the bell again. Apparently, it's the most cathartic experience people have ever had. It's this amazing experience. Again, it wasn't Shirley MacLaine or our fruits and nuts up here from Boulder. It was MIT professors. I was attending the University of Colorado Boulder at that time. I wrote a reaction paper to the Parliament of Religions, and I made the argument, and I think it's very valid, that if this is where the academic world is going, it may be just like the so-called Dark Ages, that the Christian church is the only place where the mind is still held in a good place, where rational thinking is still respected, because our culture is abandoning it. But it's still not how people live, no matter what the academics do. People still live in very real worlds. They drive real cars. They have real lives. This is a way to deal with postmodern thought. Thirdly here, people are hungry and rebellious in need of a savior. Well, if the book tells you anything about that, the popularity of the book tells you anything. It tells you that we're not out there seeking. We're in hardcore rebellion. And people need a savior. And that's what all of us are here for, is to be the people who tell them about a Savior. I put here that the response to this Paul in Athens, speaking the truth in love, if we want to get a model for how early Christians went into the pagan world and challenged them, read what Paul says in Acts 17. And there's been many good scholars from J.P. Moreland, D.A. Carson, a lot of other good writers who have done some excellent messages and stuff based on Acts 17. I highly recommend it when you walk in, because Paul was not afraid to challenge his culture. And Paul also knew his culture. He knew their own poets. He quoted them several times. And he challenged their culture. Our God does not dwell in houses made of stone and wood. He's sitting in a place where you could see hundreds of temples all around him. Slaps them right in the face. Nor is he served by human hands, as if he needed anything. Well, what does every temple have but all these priests and acolytes and wannabe priests who are out there shining the gods, feeding the gods, bathing the gods, laying the gods down for naps, just like they've done in India and Thailand for thousands of years. Or you can go to the Krishna temple down on 14th and Cherry and see the exact same phenomena. Laying it down for a nap, bathing it, feeding it. This mindset is everywhere. And Paul goes in and is not afraid to confront them with truth. And he's not afraid to confront them in love as well. So I'm not going to say any more about this. We'll have to deal with this more on another night. But if you have questions or comments about Dan Brown, I'll be here to take those afterwards. If you have any interest in our mission, we have newsletters and prayer cards and support things and stuff like that if you're interested. For the newsletter, we have a very high price. We ask you to pray. That's very expensive. I know it's beyond most people. But I will bless you with this if you sign up for the newsletter. It's like joining a Southern Baptist church or being a Democratic voter in Cook County, Illinois. Even your death will not remove you from that list, okay? So you're more than welcome to join on if you're interested in our ministry. Let's pray. Father, you are full of grace and mercy to an incredibly rebellious world. Yet I know you love Dan Brown, and you love Gim Butas, and you love Elaine Pagels as much as you love me or anybody else in this room. Father, I pray you give us an incredible passion and love for these people, the same passion and love that sent Jesus to the cross to die for them. Lord, help us to be bold. Our culture is sinking so sudden, so quickly, so incredibly dramatically. God, give us a love for these people and help us to reach out to them and bring the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the true gospel, not the false one that our world seems to be loving. Father, give us courage and give us love. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.